忘れまえや。Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 6, entitled The Demigods and Demons Declare a Truce, Text Number 31. Tatva ruchata deityasya Tatanyaye suradipa Shambhara rishtame nischa
Shambhara rishtame nischa
Yecha tripura vasina
Yecha tripura vasina
Tatva rucha ta deityasya
Tatva rucha ta deityasya
Tatanya ye suradipa
Tatanya ye suradipa
Shambhara rishtame Tripurvasina Tatvara chata deityasya Tatanya ye suradipa Shambhara rishtane mischa
Ye
cha tripurvasina
Chiefs of the Asuras.
Shambhara. Shambhara. Aristanemi. Aristanemi. Cha. Also. Ye. Others who. Cha. And. Tripuravasina.
Tripuravasina.
All the residents of Tripura.
All the residents of Tripura.
Translation. The proposals submitted by King Indra were immediately accepted by Bali Maharaj and his assistants, headed by Shambhara and Aristanemi, and by all the other residents of Tripura. Purport. It appears from this verse that politics, diplomacy, the propensity to cheat, and everything that we find in this world in individual and social negotiations between two parties are also present in the upper planetary systems. The demigods went to Bali Maharaj with a proposal to manufacture nectar, and the daityas, the demons, immediately accepting it, thinking that since the demigods were already weak, when the nectar was produced, the demons would take it from them and use it for their own purposes. The demigods, of course, had similar intention. The only difference is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, was on the side of the demigods, because the demigods were his devotees, whereas the demons did not care about Lord Vishnu. All over the universe there are two parties, the Vishnu party, or God-conscious party, and the godless party. The godless party is never happy or victorious, but the God-conscious party is always happy and victorious. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Girandana Salakya Chakshurum Nimitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitana Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is stated, Apareya mitastranyam prakritim vidime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayenam varyate jagat. That the living beings are always trying to exploit the various separated energies of Krishna that make up this material universe. So that is there throughout the entire universe. We see that the demigods and the demons both had fruitive intention. Both were interested in material advantage, but there was a great difference between the two, because the demigods are by nature pious and the demons impious. Therefore the demigods, although they want to enjoy in the material world, they will do so within the boundaries that have been determined by the Supreme Lord and revealed in the scriptures. And by adhering through these boundaries set by the Supreme Lord, by trying to enjoy the material energy within these boundaries, they are becoming purified, although they are engaging in sense gratification. But the demons, who have no interest in any restriction and want unrestricted sense gratification, they entangle themselves more and more into a network of birth and death and a network of suffering in the material energy. Such is the mechanism of the material world. By the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Maya jakshena prakite suyate satara charam hetulanena kuntya jagatri parivartite. All the living beings, the moving and the non-moving living beings, are under the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the Ajax, the Supreme Controller. So in that way, the devotees are better off, even if they have some material desire. Of course, those who take up the path of pure devotional service, they are not meant to pursue this path of sense gratification. But even then, although for the devotees the primary objective is to go back to Godhead and return to the spiritual world and to satisfy Krishna, there is a provision within Varna Ashram to satisfy material desires, but again within boundaries, and such material desires that may be satisfied in the Grihastha Ashram are secondary to devotional service, first devotional service. Otherwise, our main interest is the spiritual world. Just when Srila Prabhupada explained to Haya Griva the standards of sexual activity within the Grihastha Ashram, Kamasmi Bharatar Sabha, according to religious principles, and Prabhupada explains, yes, once a month one may try to conceive a child. Then Haya Griva said, once a month? It's hardly worth it. One may as well give it up altogether. And Prabhupada said, yes, that's the idea. That's the idea. So in this way, that is our true aim, to just dedicate all our energy into the service of Krishna. But this process of devotional service is so powerful that even if one has attachments to material sense gratification, that still, generally speaking, the process of devotional service will be successful. And one can, therefore, within this process of bhakti, it is possible to accept the Grihastha Ashram. Whereas the jnanis are basically trying to overcome the material energy by negation, by cutting all attachment, by force. For them, it is only possible to do so by following a process of very rigid discipline, extremely rigid discipline. And if they allow themselves a slight tinge of sense enjoyment, they're finished. Because the tendency for enjoying the senses is not diminishing. It is just controlled by force. But the devotee is redirecting his senses to pleasing the senses of Krishna. Rishikesha Rishikena Sevanam Bhaktir Uchate. The devotee is trying to satisfy the senses of Krishna, and that is really our process. So in this way, gradually we rise above. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur pointed out that for the devotee in the conditioned state, Varna Ashram is very essential. And obviously, practically all of us are in the conditioned state of devotional service. And that means that the desire for sense gratification is there in our heart. It's very strong. So many material desires are there. And Varna Ashram helps us to regulate these material desires. It gives us codes of behavior in the material world, kula dharma, what we are allowed to do, what we are not allowed to do, and so on. So we need this at this point in time. It is important, and actually it will be helpful to give shape to the codes of our ashram. For example, the brahmacharis in traditional Vedic culture are meant to study Vedic literature. That is important. So if one is a brahmachari, naturally, since we are conditioned souls, we'll be facing material desires. And the struggle with the pushings of the senses is very great. It is then transcendental knowledge that is a very powerful tool. Because at that stage, it is through philosophy, it is by a philosophical outlook that we can see these material desires as relative and then renounce them. We don't have yet that much higher taste. Some higher taste is there, but not that much that we can easily just rise beyond the material energy. Therefore, to become firmly fixed in transcendental knowledge is very important. Therefore, to thoroughly study Srila Prabhupada's books is very essential. Brahmachari is the student life, and then in Grihastha life, one is already established in knowledge, and B, one is also established in good habits, which will then carry forward. So one will carry on keeping a close connection to the scriptures. And in that way, we are protected. Of course, it is said, Balavan Indriyam Gramo Vidvamsim Apikarsati. The senses are so strong that even a man of learning will struggle. So knowledge is never going to be enough to overcome the material energy. No matter how much knowledge we have, yes, certainly knowledge can protect us. Philosophy can protect us. Because through this philosophy, we can see the long-term consequences of our actions. And therefore, we can see it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to engage in these activities of gross sense gratification. Because in the long term, they will cause so much suffering. But that's philosophical. But then one is weak. Still, there may be a day, you say, oh, it's too much. I cannot just always fight and battle and trying to control the mind and the senses. Then the tendency may be there to give in. So in one who follows this process of trying to conquer the senses through philosophy, one is weak and prone to fall down. But the devotee who becomes absorbed in pleasing Krishna's senses, this for Krishna, nice arrangements for Krishna, nice service for Krishna, nice cooking for Krishna, that is very nice. I remember my first Gaur Purnima, I was very new and visiting the Bhaktivedanta Manor, and just somehow or other, they engaged me and some other new devotees in rolling sweets that would be distributed later on for a big Harinam. And we were sitting in the room that is now like the reception in the Bhaktivedanta Manor, and we were just rolling endless sweet balls, and the whole room filled up with sweet balls. And I was thinking, what is this, you know? We are fasting and sitting in an ocean of sweets. I couldn't understand it. Like, what kind of... Are we trying to torture ourselves? What are we trying to do here? Actually, making such an offering for the pleasure of Krishna, all these sweets were being rolled, so that the mercy of Lord Chaitanya could be distributed to so many conditioned souls. The fact that he engaged in that, I must admit that while sitting in the middle of these suites, my lust increased. It increased. But in the long run, it diminished by being part of giving out that mercy and by being part of being an instrument of Lord Chaitanya. So in this way, gradually will overcome material desires in this process of devotional service. The demigods are devotees. They are sakkam devotees. They are devotees that will continue to maintain material desires. And they are thinking of Krishna like an order supplier. So they are approaching Krishna for fulfilling their desires, for protecting them. And they are especially becoming devotional when Krishna is, when they are in difficulty. In the process of bhakti yoga, as we are practicing, we are not only taking shelter of Krishna when we are in need. Our program is arranged around Krishna's needs. We are serving. Therefore, in serving the deity, we can immediately make a lot of advancement, because deity worship is very scheduled, and the needs of the deity are very fixed, and you can't change it. It's 4:30. It doesn't matter how tired we are or what, it's 4:30, right? And so on, and it just goes on. So in this way, it forces us to conquer the mind and senses. When we are, therefore, deity worship is especially very beneficial when we are not yet in on a spontaneous platform. At that time, it will fix us, and it will help us to overcome bad habits and so on, and change these bad habits and put good habits into place. And in this way, it purifies our external existence. The principal element in our process, though, is the Bhagavad mark. And the Bhagavad mark is basically about the glorification of Krishna. And to increase the glorification of Krishna in this world and in the next, to somehow or other do that, yes, like the essence of our Rati Yatra is the glorification of Krishna. We are, when it comes to the ritual, we all know bits and pieces, but who is so expert? We just did like a sort of a pran pratista, and it was nice. It was like, because it was transcendental, and we did it sincerely, trying to please Lord Jagannath. Doesn't mean that we are expert at these things, right? So many things didn't go right. I was gonna do this rusty vachan, and I said om, and everyone said om. And I said, okay, we're all gonna do it all together. And it was actually not meant to be like that. It was just supposed to be four brahmanas who would chant together. But anyway, Hari Bol. Because it's not so much did we follow the swasti vachana standards to the letter of the book, right? Or we did it for the pleasure of the Lord. And it was all for the glorification of the Lord. There's always the thing about the coconuts, right? These coconuts are being thrown in front of the chariot, and we just do the hocus pocus, move him 3 times to the right, 3 times to the left. Why? I don't know. They say so because that's how everybody is doing it. Somebody may know. Then we throw them and break them on the ground. Now, what are we doing there, then? Are we there breaking the coconut to capture all the inauspicious elements and just make sure that nothing like that is happening? Or, and in that case, can you eat the coconut? Right? Or is all the inauspiciousness going into the coconut? Or are we just saying, ah, well, it's Lord Chaitanya's movement, and in a way, it's like an offering to Lord Jagannath, boom, and you know, whatever's offered to him, we'll take it. We'll take the coconut. We can debate about these things forever. There are two ways to look at these things, right? I'm inclined towards the latter, right? Because I think the predominating force in our entire spiritual life is the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. Right? Otherwise, what chance would we have? I'd like to offer this this metaphor of a of the Vedic literatures or the Vedic injunctions being so many, being there like a mountain in the ocean of material existence, and we can see how between the two. There is a line, the waves of material existence are washing on the waves of the Vedic literature, which stands there like a rock, and one follows these Vedic injunctions. Then, on this ocean of material existence, a wave, a great tidal wave of Lord Chaitanya's mercy is coming and is just washing onto that beach, and the water line where the waves, when they wash into the shore, they leave a water line, the furthest point that the water came. And suddenly that wave of mercy washes further onto the beach of the Vedic literature. And suddenly the mercy of Lord Chaitanya is there. And suddenly so many roles and so on are less important. We see, for example, in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, we see some rules appearing of Vedic culture. It says, if there is a verse there, it says, anyone who eats on Ekadasi, next life, a hawk. There's another verse which says that if you've ever put out a ghee lamp that has been offered to the Lord, you know, it may have inadvertently, on purpose, happened. Then next life, blind. So, you know, quite a few of us who've done these things. So, what to do about that? But we understand, Srila Prabhupada set the standards. Being the agent of Lord Chaitanya, setting the standard is, doesn't matter. Yeah, it's not so important. And that is why sometimes we see that in India there are these differences coming up, you know, like on Ekadasi, what can you eat and what can you not eat? You can eat only papaya, and you can eat only this and that, and no eggplant, and no tomatoes, and all these things. And then Prabhupada says, no grains, beans, no mustard seeds, like that. So standards may be slightly relaxed, slightly simplified in this Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya, and not completely strictly according to the Vedic culture. But whatever standards have been given by our acharyas, that we have to follow. Narada Muni wrote the Narada Panchavatra, the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And in the Narada Panchavatra, he collected those Vedic injunctions that were favorable for the performance of bhakti. Then we see that Srila Rupa Goswami wrote the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and Sanatana Goswami, with the help of Gopabhatta Goswami, the Hari Bhakti Vilas. And those books are basically based on the Pancharatra or the Pancharatrika principles. We see both elements, the Bhagavat Vidhi and the Pancharatrika Vidhi there. So there it is established what is important for us. And then Srila Prabhupada sort of fine-tuned it for ISKCON, adjusted it a bit for the modern world, and established what we follow in our society. And in this way, everything is very clear, very clear. And in this way, the process that we are meant to follow becomes accessible. Sometimes we have people who are so much into the rules and regulations, but with that, they are not helping. They're not helping us because they make the process inaccessible. They make it inaccessible to the general public. We see that Prabhupada didn't do that. Therefore, when Prabhupada told us deity worship, three principles are important. Cleanliness, punctuality, and simplicity. So that simplicity is nice because it makes it accessible. It means that even if you're not a specialist, you can still do it. Which is important. If it becomes so much wrapped up in so much ritual, so many rules, and everything has to be, then you have to, only professional pujaris can manage it. But simple, like this. So, Krishna consciousness is simple for the simple. I'll end then with a statement of Tribhuvanath. It is not recorded anywhere in the Vedabase, but not everything that Prabhupada said or did was recorded, believe it or not. Right? There are actually some things that that devotees remember. Generally, Satsarupa Maharaj, when he was interviewing people for the Lilamrita, had a strict standard that he wouldn't include stories that came from one person. He would take only stories that were confirmed by a second person. So I think in general, that's a good policy, but if the person is of a very high caliber, then we'll accept, like Tribhuvanath. Tribhuvanath said that that Prabhupada made the statement once that Krishna consciousness, this was in an address, an arrival address, or I think an arrival address. He was saying Krishna consciousness is so simple that you might just miss it. And I really find that a very profound statement. So, very simple. We have to, but because we have material desire, we want more. We just can't be satisfied with it being so simple. Who can be so simple? Modern people don't want life so simple. We want variety, complexity, different flavors, different things. And different. Is there anything new? Right? No. is just very simple. But Krishna is ever fresh. Anyway, so like this, we are seeing how in the community of the demigods and the demons, because there are material desires, then we see that the propensity to cheat is also there. It said politics, diplomacy, and the propensity to cheat is there. Now in the fourth canto, there is a description about Prithu Maharaj. And it's interesting because it is said that Prithu Maharaj was also into diplomacy. And is also into diplomacy. But Prithu Maharaj is unlike the demigods, he is like the emblem of the pure devotee. But it's said that he was very diplomatic about his treasury. No one knew how much he had, no one knew where it was. It was just diplomatic, covering that. So we see that even diplomacy has a place. Even politics has a place in Krishna consciousness. There's nothing wrong with politics if it's pure politics. If politics, yes, politics are basically arrangements to get people to act in certain ways by maneuvering. Right? So what's wrong with that? One devotee complained to Prabhupada and said that, you know, I don't like Indians. Prabhupada said, oh? He said, why not? He said, because they're very tricky. Prabhupada said, oh, I'm also Indian. He said, no, no, not you, Prabhupada, not you. Prabhupada said, no, I am very tricky. I tricked you all into Krishna consciousness. So that kind of politics, to trick people into Krishna consciousness, is good politics. So even there is room for politics and diplomacy in our movement, right? And it exists, and it may be completely pure if it is for the pleasure of Krishna. Right? So one may have an idea, and one may think it's a good idea. So then it's natural to first go look for some support. Find some supporters for the idea, and then present it to the authorities. We, right, rather than I, right, that's politics. That's politics. But that's good politics. So in this way, the problem comes when the fruitive element comes in. And as soon as the fruitive element comes in, the propensity to cheat comes in. Because then it's driven by lust and greed. But the demigods regulate it and control it according to principles of Dharma, with the demons in its uncontrolled, brutal form, like that. Okay. So that sort of sums it up. Are there any questions or comments? Okay.
Oh,
good.
Very often I hear from many practicing devotees that wherever you go, is haunted politics going on in temple.
Yeah.
How to take these? How to take those, like, you know, statements? And sometimes I hear from many.
Oh, definitely. Wherever you go, politics is going on. Absolutely. It's always there. Yeah. And it's like, even in Dwarka, at the time of Krishna, politics was there. There was gossip, there were accusations, you know, this Shamatak and jewel story, and Krishna, rumors about Krishna, and so on. Politics is natural. But the pure devotees, they don't get involved with this gossiping or they just get involved with glorifying Krishna. But when it is, when they strongly feel that a particular goal is important to pursue for Krishna, they are ready to campaign, they are ready to speak to the right people who might support them. Yeah? But if somehow or other their idea doesn't prevail, yeah, then they're detached. Well, Krishna had another desire. They're detached. But the mundane person I'm getting in is engaged in politics for personal gain. So politics can be there for getting some profit, some goods for sense enjoyment, or a position for sense enjoyment, or politics can be there out of envy. By putting others down, I'll look better. So, some politics is driven by envy, criticizing others unnecessarily, just so that we look more glorious. So this is all the petty politics of material existence. And naturally, we bring some of that with us in our hand luggage. So the politics is going on outside the temple, inside the temple. Yeah, it's going on everywhere. One devotee, I met him in Finland, he worked for Nokia in America. And he had he was a software specialist, he made some new software for Nokia. And then in Finland you have all the Nokia factories, so many. And then from Finland a message came, no, the software doesn't work. And so, you know, he tested it in America and it worked fine. And from Finland again, and he sent the message, you do this and this. And again, the message came from Finland, it doesn't work. So finally, the company sent him to Finland, right, to help them to make it work. And when he came, then after a short while, he realized it wasn't that the program didn't work, it was just that one particular person tried to make a competitor look bad. So he put out the whole thing, it doesn't work, and in this way, make his competitor look bad so that he wouldn't get the promotion, and that he would get the promotion. Call that politics. And so he's saying, you know, working in Nokia is too much, there's too much politics. In the temples there may be some politics, but it's not as bad as in the world. And gradually we get purified. So the first thing to do when we rise above the neophyte platform is to rise above the low level of politics, of material politics. And not entertain it, not hear it, and not engage in it. And that's the Madhyamadhikari's business. So we must become like that. At least Madhyamadhikari. Then who cares about the politics? You know, there are germs in the temple. There are disease. There's disease in the temple. You know that? You heard it? Yes, there's disease in the temple. There's disease outside of the temple. It's natural. There's disease everywhere in the material world. Politics everywhere, disease everywhere. Is that a reason to shun the temple? No. Those who leave the temple because they are saying there are too many politics in the temple, they found a convenient excuse. They were looking for an excuse so they could get back into sense verification. So, nothing to worry about. A little bit of politics won't kill you. Finished. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Mr. Namakana Maharaj.